Picture Genetics is a new and unique DNA testing service. These tests are designed for every stage of life, from family planning and newborn health to personal wellness and disease risk. Unlike other companies, this is actually a clinical-grade test where physicians and genetic counselors are involved in the process. The test sequences entire genes that are medically actionable. It's easy to order and understand with good-looking reports. To order your Picture Genetics, go to picturegenetics.com and use code DNA today for 25% off plus free shipping. Get actionable genetic insights today to benefit your family of tomorrow.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. On this show, we explore genetics' impact on our health through conversations with leaders in genetics. These are experts like fellow genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. This episode is part of our ongoing direct consumer genetic testing series. I am joined by the award-winning journalist, Libby Copeland. Libby, who writes about culture, science, and human behavior, is the author of a new book, The Lost Family: How DNA Testing is Upending Who We Are, which explores the personal, familial, and ethical implications of recreational DNA testing. Copeland was a reporter and editor at the Washington Post for 11 years and has a media fellow and guest lecturer and has made numerous appearances on television and radio. Welcome to the show, Libby Copeland. Thank you so much for coming on to discuss law enforcement's use of direct consumer genetic testing today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
And I have to say, before we launch into the interview, I just loved the book, The Lost Family, for people that haven't read it yet. It was just, it's such an easy read, and I learned so much. I mean, someone that's been in genetics for a few years now, I was like, oh, this will probably be information I've heard before, but you phrase it in such an easy way that you're intertwining all of these people's stories to explore so much in direct consumer genetic testing. We're just talking about law enforcement today, but it was such a pleasure to read, and I had my highlighter out, and just so many areas that were so interesting and so many people that you talked to incorporate so much information.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it was absolutely an adventure to report and write this book. I found it completely fascinating. I think that this topic touches on so many really important human themes that I just, you know, it was just absolutely a thrill to be able to report and write this book.
I think that's a really good comment, that it really does touch on so many areas of like the human experience, and from families to, you know, we're going to get into law enforcement to health side, ancestry. I mean, there's so many different areas of direct consumer that's why that there's the series on the show, but there's just so much to explore and analyze and reflect on. And that really comes through in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of the themes that DNA testing brings to the fore are important to all of us, whether or not we've tested, because they have to do with questions about identity and self and family and love and privacy and things that, you know, even those of us who never spit into a vial, and certainly those of us who do, we've been thinking about these questions all our lives, actually. There's basically essential human questions. And so I think that the themes that I explore in The Lost Family are questions that people have thought about actually for centuries. DNA testing just gives us a new and often more dramatic way, a lens of looking at them.
It's such a good way of putting it. And one thing you kind of teased in the rest of our interview is that you don't necessarily have to, you know, spit and send it off to one of these companies to be affected by this. And I think we'll see that. I thought we could set the scene with a groundbreaking study in 2013 that you talk about in your book, where a team was able to fully identify men who had anonymously donated DNA samples for research. Can you take us through like what this study, how they went about doing this, and what were the implications of this study? At the time, it wasn't really groundbreaking, but a couple years after, it became so.
Yes. So Yaniv Ehrlich and a team of other scientists were very interested in exploring how research genomes that had been donated and kept anonymous. In other words, the people who donated them had not been identified, whether they could be potentially be identified. And Ehrlich was interested in this because he wanted to know what were the privacy implications and possible complications for people who had sort of selflessly donated their genomes for research. And so what they were able to find was that they were able to take five of these research genomes and actually figure out who they belonged to. And they were able to do this by taking the information that was publicly available, which was the genetic data, but also some limited non-identifying information, and put it into a kind of public database that looked at Y DNA, so DNA on the Y chromosome. This was a sort of a public database that genealogists were using, that they were researching the commonalities between surnames and the Y chromosome. So a man typically gets passed down two things from his father. He gets his father's Y chromosome and he gets his last name, not always his last name, but typically. And those commonalities have for a long time allowed genealogists to research their own family trees. So using this information in this public database, Ehrlich and his colleagues were able to identify five of these anonymous research genomes and then many members of their family. So they were able to ultimately identify close to 50 people. And this was actually at the time, as Ehrlich described it to me, kind of a risky move. He was upsetting some people in his world by showing the limitations of privacy when it came to how you can combine, you know, the internet and genetic data. But it was really very prescient. He was really seeing into the future, and he was really predicting in many ways what would happen just a few years later with the capture of the alleged Golden State Killer.
Yeah, and that it really set the stage for, okay, let's look at genetic privacy and like, where are we at with this? How can you discover other people that, you know, DNA, how much can it really be de-identified? That's kind of a term that we use to say, okay, this sample is no longer connected with a person that you can kind of draw it back to, but how accurate is that? Can we be doing this? And with his study, he showed that there are ways to do this with that Y DNA, which I wanted to kind of side note for a minute just to talk about Y DNA, because people may say, what the heck is Y DNA? And when people are doing direct consumer tests, such as like ancestry testing, autosomal DNA is usually what they're looking at primarily, which is your chromosomes 1 through 22. But there are sex chromosomes, XY for males, XX for females. So only men, typically, when we're looking at biological sex, have the Y chromosome. As you said, it's passed down from father to son throughout generations. And so it can help with ancestry testing. But how many companies have this option to look at this Y chromosome information as opposed to just the autosomal information?
Right. It's relatively unusual. It's more of a niche category. So there's four major DNA testing companies when it comes to recreational DNA testing. Ancestry DNA is the big one. 23andMe is also very big just behind them. There's MyHeritage and there's Family Tree DNA, which is the smallest and also the oldest. It was founded in 2000, just about exactly 20 years ago. It sent out its first kits for people to test. So Family Tree DNA is the only one that offers Y DNA and mitochondrial DNA as sort of standalone testing. And they're typically much less useful for genealogical purposes, but there are cases where Y DNA can be helpful, particularly when you combine it with the surname correlation, the correlation between the Y chromosome and the surname. There have been cases that have been solved, or genealogists have solved cases in their own family trees by using this.
And so with Y DNA, it also links back to law enforcement using this in the past. How did that work with law enforcement using this?
Yeah, so if you look at the Golden State Killer case, for instance, I know that law enforcement was trying to use DNA to tackle the problem of who this homicidal, you know, rapist and serial killer, who he was, at least as far back as 2011, using Y DNA. There is a forensic genealogist, I guess you would call her, Colleen Fitzpatrick, who told me that she'd been working with investigators as far back as 2011 using Y-DNA. And there's particular instances back in 2017. For instance, Paul Holes, who was an investigator on the case, he had been experimenting with trying to use DNA to solve this case for quite some time. And he told me about trying to use Y-DNA back in 2017. And it did not yield what they were able to achieve just about a year later with autosomal DNA, which really is so incredibly rich that it was, you know, it was remarkable in terms of what they could understand from not even a very large pool of people when they ultimately went that route.
It's interesting with direct consumer databases that you don't just need, oh, your mother or your brother is in the database. As far as, I don't know, like some cousins, maybe first cousin, second cousin, can lead back to the person that law enforcement is trying to find. I've mentioned the Golden State Killer case a few times on the show, but never really dived into exactly how the sequence of events of being able to identify him, how were they able to use these databases? Where did they start after the Y-DNA wasn't really leading to the killer?
So they took the crime scene DNA and they put that genetic information from the crime scene DNA into something called GEDmatch. So GEDmatch is basically a repository for people who have tested at one of the major recreational DNA testing companies. They download their information and then upload it to GEDmatch so that they can compare across different platforms. So again, across different databases, and also use other tools to understand. So it's really this very, it's a site for hobbyists, people who are very, very into genetic genealogy and are typically uploading to better understand their family history and make comparisons that way. So what police did was they used basically like an undercover profile. So they created a profile for this crime scene DNA, and then they looked for relatives. And the database at the time was so small that they were really looking at more distant third and fourth cousins. And what they were doing was they were using techniques that have been used by genetic genealogists going back to about 2010, but they were using them in this case in a new way. They were using them to solve a crime. And they were going back looking for a most recent common ancestor among those cousins. And then they were tracing forward back in time using a technique that's sometimes referred to as reverse genealogy to look for modern day descendants who might not be in the database and you know, in fact, are not in that database, but fit the profile in terms of demographics and location, and also that their DNA fits in the right spot in the family tree. And that is how they were able to identify the person that they figured was a person of interest in the case. And then they needed to actually confirm it by picking up, you know, typically in a case like this, it might be like a tissue or a straw or something that has the culprit, the suspected culprit's DNA on it that's been discarded in a public place. And then they compare that to the crime scene sample, and they look for a match. And that's what happened with the case of the Golden State Killer.
There's so many elements there of, it's not just genetic testing. Oh, this person came up and that's a match, you know, go arrest them. You're looking at finding a most common ancestor and looking at, as you said, those demographics and so many layers of information to pull this together. But without the genetic testing in these databases, like GED match, like it's not able to really be done. Like this case was open for what, 50 years around there?
Yeah, I think it was like 44 years, something like that. And I think what you're pointing to is something very important. This is not just something that DNA alone can accomplish. You also have to be somebody who understands how to build trees. And so you need really somebody who's well-versed in genealogy and can do genetic genealogy and can use the power of the internet. You're really pulling together many different technological forces. So it's not just the DNA, it's also social media. It's also the wealth of information that's available on the internet. It's the extent to which our lives are now lived publicly online, combined with the DNA, combined with the shared genetic segments that I might share with my genetic can, that makes it possible for investigators to find someone who never themselves spit into a vial.
And it's interesting because, as you said, all of these different areas, it's really all of these different data points and bases, because your social media presence and the demographic information the police may have and the databases that they're all pooling together to be able to find this information. And that's starting to be where we're going today and how law enforcement is able to use this. But before we get to exactly how this has now changed, because the Golden State Killer has been a couple years now since that's happened, how did their databases work before? There's something called CODIS I've heard of that law enforcement still use today, but how was it before the Golden State Killer to really have a juxtaposition of what we're doing today?
Right. So in the past, investigators were solely reliant, if they wanted to use DNA, on kind of a network of local, state, and federal databases that are colloquially known as CODIS, as you say. And the type of DNA that's used within CODIS is different from the genotyping approach that the recreational DNA testing companies are using. And what that means is that they are really only able to find So you're really looking to see if the person you're searching for is already in the database. So if they're like they've been arrested or they're a convicted felon, they may have had their DNA taken and their genetic information placed into CODIS. In some states, it's possible to do familial searching, but the type of DNA that's used in CODIS is only good for predicting very close relationships like parent and child, or like siblings. So what's known as long-range familial searching, which is looking for third, fourth cousins, that's simply not possible within CODIS. So basically, you're in a situation where you're looking for, say, a killer in this instance. But if that criminal's DNA isn't already in CODIS or someone very closely related to them, you're not going to be able to find anything. And just to give you evidence of this, I mean, the Golden State Killer's DNA has been in CODIS since, I think, 2001. And that system, as I understand it, continually runs searches for matches. And because he was not in there, right, because the man who would later be arrested for these crimes was not in there, they could not find a match, nor was there like a sibling or a parent. So there's certainly been many, many thousands of cases solved through CODIS, but it just doesn't have the power of the kind of DNA technology that's being used in recreational DNA databases and the public ones.
Speaking of genetic databases, I wanted to let you listeners know about Genobank. Genobank is the first anonymous DNA storage and sharing platform that is completely controlled by you with blockchain technology. Other companies, as we're talking about on this episode with Libby Copeland, share their data and it's not locked down. Here's the really cool aspect about Genobank. You can choose who you are sharing your DNA with, including researchers. That's right, you can be a partner in research by choosing specific institutions who can use your DNA in their research projects. Genobank is like a matchmaker between researchers and people like you who want to contribute their DNA towards scientific advancements. You can even get paid for your valuable DNA. You also have the control to decide how long researchers have access to your genetic information. Keep an eye on Genobank as they are launching this fall. Get a sneak peek at genobank.io. There you can sign up to be a part of their beta program and learn more. Again, that's genobank.io to join the genomic revolution. In the book, you mentioned that CODIS uses what's known as STR DNA testing, so looking at short tandem repeats. So these are when you have kind of two letters that are repeating, and depending on how many times they repeat in a person, that's how it's looked at. So it's very limited in terms of what genetic information it's looking at, but that also it doesn't really include any health information. It's more of an identifier of people, whereas with some of these databases and what the information that they may have can include health information. I mean, that's often what people are looking at when they're, you know, spitting into these tubes and sending them off to companies is health information along with the ancestry. But now that we have these large databases with Ancestry, as you mentioned, being the largest, have there been other criminals caught through these databases that are from the direct consumer companies? So not the CODIS and other ones that the police officers were using before, but now ones that are company owned.
Right. So the major databases are closed off to police. They don't permit police to do these kind of searches within their databases. So major databases, Ancestry, generally, you know, refuses law enforcement requests, 23andMe and MyHeritage. They could be subpoenaed, but at this point, I don't know of any successful law enforcement motions against any of these companies to gather genetic information. So the only companies, generally speaking, or the major companies that law enforcement turns to are GEDmatch, which was always envisioned as kind of a public or quasi-public forum. And then there is one company called Family Tree DNA, which I mentioned earlier, which is the oldest recreational DNA testing company. And they have decided to allow law enforcement to also access their database and use, you know, attempt to solve crimes through their database.
So between GEDmatch and Family Tree DNA, those are the ones that are accessible for law enforcement to use at this time, but there's the potential that they could get what you said was a subpoena in order to access, but that hasn't happened yet, but it could in the future.
They've been saying that they would fight them, and there have been some sort of legal tests, so it's an open question. I mean, there are people who say, yes, this could be a concern in the future.
So are there any laws or protections to prevent law enforcement from then being able to access these databases? I mean, right now companies are saying, no, we're not allowing you to, but are there any actual laws to do this or any efforts to add laws?
So at the moment, it seems to be a question of private industry and what kind of limits they want to set. And you see this kind of play out interestingly with Family Tree DNA, because that is an example of a company that sort of its founders made decisions to permit the FBI to have access to the database for this purpose. And that is interesting and important to privacy experts, because it essentially puts business CEOs in the position of making decisions about the privacy of potentially millions of consumers' DNA.
And with these companies, they have what are called like opt-in or opt-out policies. How has this changed since Golden State Killer case and like to now? What are most of the policies?
Right. So GEDmatch currently has a policy that you are automatically opted out, but you can opt into law enforcement use of your genetic information. Now, it didn't used to be that way. Back in 2018, after the Golden State Killer was caught, GEDmatch founders did a lot of soul searching and ultimately decided that this was a good use and allowed this use and kind of notified all their users so that users could remove their genetic information if they didn't like their genetic information being used to solve homicides and sexual assaults. And then along the way, the founders of GEDmatch decided to make an exception for a particularly egregious case that was neither a homicide nor a sexual assault. And in the kind of privacy outcry that followed among some genetic genealogists, but a very vocal group of genetic genealogists who used GEDmatch and didn't like the idea that an exception had been made, the company changed its policy and they made it so that you had to actively opt into your DNA being used for particularly egregious crimes, but a slightly broader suite of crimes. Family Tree DNA, I believe last time I checked, they were using sort of the opposite approach. So you're automatically opted in unless you choose to opt out.
So it really depends on the company, and consumers should be looking at company policies to see how theirs is set up. What would you say for people that themselves haven't yet done a direct consumer test but are considering doing one? What should they think about before making that decision?
So, I mean, at the moment, if you're testing at one of the bigger companies, there have not been law enforcement implications for you unless you decided to go ahead and download your information and upload it to GEDmatch, for instance, and then opt into law enforcement searching. So as far as law enforcement implications, thus far, that has not been an issue. But there's certainly other concerns that I've heard voiced concerning the possibility of, for instance, in the future, a company being bought by another company and maybe their privacy policies being different, or your genetic information being breached, or the possibility of genetic discrimination through an insurance company in the future. Most of these are hypotheticals, but I think the thing is that we kind of don't know how our genetic information could be used in the future. And so that is a concern to a lot of people. And I know genetic genealogists will say, you know, if someone's hesitating about DNA testing, like, it's not your role to kind of persuade them because you don't know what their hesitation is about. And you don't know how that concern could manifest in the future. And I think, you know, one of the biggest issues that I saw as I was reporting my book was concerns about family secrets coming out into the open. And a lot of the reason why people may hesitate now does have to do with that question of, am I opening a Pandora's box? The vast majority of people who test are not going to find that there's something, you know, sort of huge and shocking and disruptive in their family tree. And they're going to have, from what I understand from my interviews, often, you know, kind of a deepening of their understanding of their own genetic ancestry and their family history. But there's a significant minority of people who do discover something kind of shocking, and that causes them to question their own identity and their sort of place in their family. And that can be a truly sort of seismic revelation. And that is a kind of a privacy concern that a lot of people do think about too.
It's advantageous to take a moment before doing these tests and thinking through what the possibilities are and how it can affect not just yourself, but other people in the family, and in ways that may not be happening right now, as you said, of just how the future could be of companies buying out other companies and laws changing. And it will be interesting to see how things do progress with this. I mean, direct consumers have been very interesting in genetics for years, and I imagine years to come. One last question before we close out the show. How much of the American population could be identified from these direct consumer databases? We've talked about being able to identify someone through, you know, a second or third cousin. But how many people in America right now could be identified through these databases, even if they're not in there themselves?
Sure. Well, if you're talking about this for law enforcement purposes, it's a different answer than if you're talking about it if you were to, for instance, spit into a vial through Ancestry, for example. So the work that Yaniv Ehrlich did found that you would need approximately 3 million people in a database in order for 99% of the white European population in the United States to be identifiable. Now, there's not yet 3 million people, as far as I know, in the two databases that make up the pool of people that law enforcement has access to if they're doing that kind of searching. But as far as the recreational DNA testing pool as a whole, there's at least, I think, 30 million people. If you look at Ancestry DNA, 23andMe, MyHeritage, and FamilyTree DNA combined. So you've many times over exceeded that kind of number that's needed to find the vast majority of people of at least white European descent, which was the population that Ehrlich was looking at and that is most commonly represented in these databases.
And I imagine these numbers will just continue to increase with databases growing, maybe not at the same rate they were, but that they're going to continue to grow. And so this is an area that's very interesting to continue following. And want to thank you so much for coming on the show and exploring these topics with me. It's so interesting to see just all the areas that direct consumers can be implicating, and that people can learn so much more in your book, The Lost Family. Highly recommend it. And for people that are regular listeners to this show, you're going to recognize a couple names, including Brianne Kirkpatrick, that's been on the show a couple times. So definitely recommend the book. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for the fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
We're on a roll with another giveaway as part of our ongoing direct consumer genetic testing series. You can enter to win a copy of Libby Copeland's The Lost Family by heading over to our social media. Just search DNA Today on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram if you want the direct handles. Twitter and Facebook is at DNA Podcast, whereas Instagram is at DNA Radio. You can look for the post. It's a picture of me holding a copy of the book, and there's more details on there on how to enter. I swear it's very easy. The other giveaway we're doing right now is a mentoring session with myself about getting into genetic counseling programs. This is going to be a 1-hour Zoom call, and we're going to talk about your resume, your essay, and how to improve your application to get into genetic counseling programs. So you can also head over to our social media to enter that. One portion of it is sending in a review on Apple Podcasts, or if you don't have access to Apple Podcasts, another podcast where you can leave a review for the show. And as a bonus, when you follow us, you're not going to miss any other giveaways that are coming up. That way, if you're behind on episodes, you're still going to have a chance to enter our giveaways. And if you want to order your copy right now of Libby Copeland's The Lost Family, head over to our website, libbycopeland.com, and be sure to give her a follow on Twitter at Libby Copeland. She makes it easy. Head over to dnapodcast.com if you would like to listen to over 125 episodes of the show. Not all of them are available on the podcast app because usually they cap you at 100, so we've got more than that. Head over dnapodcast.com. You can also search DNA Today in your podcast app if you happen to be listening to this on the radio. Be sure to subscribe. Any questions you have for myself, for Libby, any other previous guests, you have an idea for the show, you just want a shout out, email in info@dnapodcast.com. Before ending the show, I wanted to remind you about the sponsor of this DTC series, Picture Genetics, with their exclusive 25% discount for you as a DNA Today listener. Picture Genetics is different from a traditional direct consumer test because it's clinical grade testing with every case reviewed by a healthcare provider. Results are focused on health with medically actionable and useful information for you and your family. I actually did a couple of their kits, including their Picture Parenting one. Here's how it worked. I sent off my tube of spit to their lab, who sequenced a bunch of genes. This basically means they read through each gene to see if there was a mutation or pathogenic variants, as we genetic counselors call them. Then a physician or genetic counselor looked at my results and created a beautifully easy-to-read report, informing me about my carrier results. Here's my favorite part. There also is genetic counseling offered, so you can speak with a genetic counselor about your results, so there's no confusion. Order your own kit at picturegenetics.com and use code DNA Today for 25% off and free shipping. Again, that's picturegenetics.com. Get actionable genetic insights today to benefit your family of tomorrow. Be sure to check out Genobank. As I mentioned before, they are the first anonymous DNA storage and sharing platform. Genobank allows you to participate in the genomic revolution with maximized privacy through blockchain networks to keep track of all the data sets and genomic reports without exposing your personal data and your family's data. Genobank creates a way for you to decide who has access to your genetic information. The aspect I'm most intrigued by is how you can take part in research to further science by choosing specific institutions and even projects to contribute your DNA to. Check it out. That's at genobank.io. Again, genobank.io. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you, and they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.